believe in Santa Claus? Well, if you don't, by the time we finish this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse, you will. Because my guest tonight, Richard Hope, is here to talk about a book that he has written called Santa Claus, A Guidebook for Grown-Ups. How about that as a concept? Huh? Because mostly we think of Santa Claus stories, books, images for children, not for grown-ups. And he is going to explain to us what he has in this. This book is full of facts about St. Nicholas. We're going to go back through the history, and he's going to fill us in on all that. Richard Hope was born in Frankfurt, Germany, and an American father and British mother. His education in the U.S. and Europe ultimately included a bachelor's degree in history from Ohio State University, summa cum laude, and his honors thesis concerned Oliver Cromwell's deliberations on whether to accept the British crown in 1657. Oliver, by the grace of God, almost king. Does that seem like a lot of water under the bridge since you wrote that, Richard?
Oh, it's been a while. It's definitely been a while.
His next step was Harvard Law School for a J.D. degree, magna cum laude, a brief stint as an editor of the Harvard Law Review, and that is a huge position for a law student.
It was mostly assigned on the basis of grades, and I did it for a year. I had another interest at the same time. I was very deeply involved in the law school show, and I had done theater as an undergraduate and in high school. So I eventually decided that I would prefer to do theater.
What is law school doing with a show?
Well, they had actually a lot of ringers into...
who were not law students.
Who were not law students. Okay. And they were satirizing the law school and the legal profession and so forth.
Just for fun.
Just for fun.
That's great stuff.
So I was composing the music, and then that year I ended up quitting the Law Review in order to direct the show.
Oh, all right. Is that important to you? And also your interest in writing, because to be the editor of the review and then to have written this book and others, big interest in writing. After clerking for justice for the Alaska Supreme Court, newly minted lawyer Hope went to New York to litigate contested takeovers. And he left the wars of corporate piracy in 1983 to spend the next 18 years as a more sedate corporate counsel at AT&T Corporation and ultimately its spinoff, Lucent Technologies.
And eventually Avaya.
Avaya.
Yeah.
Exactly. Among other things, Mr. Hope specialized in international business law. So he retired from full-time corporate law in 2001 and dabbled in politics as a speechwriter for the Libertarian Party candidate for U.S. Senate from New Jersey. He moved to Easton, Pennsylvania in 2003 and has published A History of the Town. Now, that one I have not read yet. I must get to it.
Huh.
All right. I hope that they're selling it at the Siegel Museum.
They are. Actually, mm-hmm. They tell me it's their best-selling book. So
wow.
You can certainly get a copy from them.
All right.
Then there are several others that have been follow-ons from that.
And you have just retired from college teaching.
Haven't quite retired. Well, yes, actually have retired at this mm-hmm. point. And yes.
What did you teach?
Business law for the most part, some HR and a few things like that, but mostly business law.
Uh-huh. So what an interesting career. So Richard Hope, my question to you right off the bat is, how did you get interested in the topic of Santa Claus? Here you come from a law background. You're teaching at the college level. How does Santa come into the picture?
Well, I have on occasion played Santa Claus, actually, somewhat frequently. And I saw articles purporting to be the history of Santa Claus, which seemed very fanciful and not very satisfactory from a historian's standpoint. And I also was interested in what exactly is the nature of Santa Claus? What are we talking about here? So I didn't really find a lot that was pertinent to the question, although a few things here and there. So I started researching it and you know how these projects go. Sometimes say like they grow like Topsy, grow. It just growed, you know. So it ultimately became the book with the history and the more philosophical discussion in the back on what is Santa Claus, and then some tips on how to play Santa Claus based on mostly on my experiences doing it. And internationally, of course, I traveled around a good deal with my work, so I had occasion both from published sources and also by looking at things. I lived in Holland for a while and so on, to include what Santa Claus looked like or the whatever the analog was around the world in many different cultures and countries.
And you're hooked on history, obviously.
Yes, unfortunately. So, this is true.
No, that's not unfortunate. on the contrary, but I see now where your interest goes. You wanted to go way back to the beginning and see, well, how did even St. Nicholas come about, and how did the story develop? And we're going to talk about that on Lehigh Valley Discourse this evening. So, basic question, how old is Santa Claus?
About 1,700 years old.
Ooh.
He is old. Every child will tell you that he's old.
This is true.
So this is consistent with every child's understanding.
However, a child would say that a 45-year-old person is old.
Well, it is relative.
So 1,700 years. And St. Nicholas was a person. We
yes.
believe that he did exist.
Yes.
And he was a bishop?
He was a bishop. In Roman times, he was a contemporary of Constantine the Great, when Christianity was achieving respectable status in the Roman Empire, which, of course, it really hadn't been before. And he established it as the de facto religion of the empire, although there were many others at that time that were permitted. And part of the problem, Christianity had been persecuted at times before that. So Nicholas apparently became a bishop during the Diocletian persecution, when no one was particularly anxious for the job because you were likely to find yourself either in prison or executed or worse.
Ooh.
So, but he was apparently a very brash young man, and he was willing to take the job, and so they gave it to him.
What century are we talking here?
We are talking the 300s, and he was part of the legend, although it's disputed, is that he was at the council where the Nicene Creed was established, and Constantine really established his stranglehold on Christianity as an instrument of state policy. Nicholas was a supporter of Constantine's party, ultimately.
So it's possible that St. Nicholas was a party, was included in these deliberations.
Yes. The tradition is that he was, in fact, that he somewhat negatively distinguished himself at the council by literally physically getting into a fist fight with one of his opponents on the floor of the convention. Disciplined for doing that and ultimately pardoned. But
sounds like the British Parliament.
But it's been argued both ways, that and there is some respectable authority that he may have actually been there. Lists of people who were there do not include him, but the other side of the argument has been that the lists are incomplete and that additions to it were actually legitimate. So you can argue that either way.
Does it bother you, with your interest in history, not to have facts that almost everybody agrees on as historical fact?
It actually doesn't. I find it more interesting, and maybe that's the litigator in me, because that's, of course, was my original job. I see it as you set out both sides of the argument, and then you carefully say where the sources came from. You identify who said what, and then you let the reader decide. Mm-hmm. And everyone should have the right to decide for themselves.
And in this particular case, I sense from what you've said about St. Nicholas that he might have been included in important deliberations, about Christianity or might not have been that you lean toward his being included?
I think that's my bent, yes. I think Constantine was gathering support, all the support he could get from wherever in the empire he could get it. Nicholas was a bishop in a very outlying province. I mean, he was from the sticks.
All right. So not particularly important.
No, not at all, although he periodically turns up, again, according to the oldest legends. He had an effect on one of the campaigns to put down a rebellion against the central power and so on and so forth. But he was not a central political figure at all in his day. But he may well have been one of the bumpkins from the sticks, you know, brought in to support the head man. And being such a bumpkin from the sticks and being very passionate about whatever he did, he ends up quite plausibly, from the other things that we know about him, getting into a fist fight in the middle of the conference.
All right. Yeah, you've called him brash.
Yes, I think passionate. That's a fair from the stories that we've been told about him, and especially the stories, of course, tend to be overblown and they got
embellished,
magnified over the centuries. But but the oldest stories always have him being this very laid forward kind of a guy.
Uh-huh. Well, how did anyone hear of this backcountry bishop then?
Well, the backcountry area that he was bishop of was a town, a port city of Myra.
Which is in Turkey.
It is in Turkey. It's in the southwestern coast. And it actually is a jumping off point. If you're sailing as they did in those days, bouncing along the coast to get anywhere, it was sort of the last bounce that you would take before you did the shortcut across the open sea to get down to what we now call the Holy Land. And in Constantine's day, they would have thought of it the same way, too. Constantine's relatives, his mother-in-law especially, you know, was the one who established pilgrimages to Jerusalem. So if you were taking a ship, which was one of the practical ways to do it if you could afford it, this was a jumping-off place for a particularly dangerous crossing across the open sea to cut the corner off of that Turkish peninsula. So people were always very happy to get a saint to help them on their way. And when they got back safely, they would give thanks to the saint. So it was an important spot. And indeed, Nicholas, as the bishop that sort of established the bishopric there and was enshrined there, his relics were entombed there, as the local saint that tended to be the place where travelers, pilgrims especially to the Holy Land, would ask for assistance, as they did in those days, and then give offerings when they got back safely. So it became a real moneymaker for people in the Eastern Roman Empire, for pilgrims, to get money from pilgrims, as one does to this day, of course, with as Bethlehem well knows, with people who come to town and spend their money at the casino.
Yes, indeed.
There were other things to do than official gambling at that time.
Right. There's a shrine in Myra.
There is.
Now, did that spread the St. Nicholas cult beyond the Byzantine Empire?
That shrine did to some extent. To the extent that there were pilgrims, they did know of it, especially seafaring people like the Normans later on, quite late, several centuries later. Apparently, when they did tours, especially the Norman Count, the Angevin Count, the Black Hawk, and so on, who was a father to the Angevin dynasty of English kings, had done a pilgrimage, and apparently it was a rough crossing, and he was particularly grateful to Nicholas, to the point that when he got home, he established his own chapel to Nicholas there on the coast of France. But, so yes, it was a moneymaker, and yes, it was known, but I couldn't truthfully say in those early centuries that Nicholas had much of an international reputation, except among the odd Zod who actually made their pilgrimage and so forth, right. which tended to be wealthier people and so forth. It wasn't until much later that Nicholas became the saint of everybody, and he spread more by political means. Apparently he became popular in Constantinople. And again, that may have been simply because people from Constantinople were following the example of the emperor's in-laws and making their pilgrimages, so they knew of him. But not that long later, by the standards of the day, certainly by the 600s, and probably much earlier than that, there was already a church in Constantinople dedicated in part to him, set up by the emperor. And the imperial family was into St. Nicholas, if you will. So it became an important cult in the empire and in Constantinople.
My guest on Lehigh Valley Discourse this evening is Richard Hope, who has written a book called Santa Claus, A Guidebook for Grown-Ups. And the Santa Claus story comes to us from the historical figure of St. Nicholas, and we're tracing that early history with Richard Hope right now, going way back to what is now Turkey, the town of Myra.
Mm-hmm.
Myra still exists?
It does. It has a Turkish name now, of course, but Nicholas himself was born in a nearby village. And actually the story that made him Santa Claus probably occurred before he was a bishop in his hometown rather than when he was actually a bishop.
Well, we're going to get into that after we take a break. We're going to talk about the popularity of St. Nicholas in medieval Europe. And then eventually, as we get into more modern times, times of the Enlightenment and beyond that, and then the crossing over the Atlantic Ocean to the U.S. and see what's happened to this whole story of St. Nicholas and Santa Claus as we know it today. So stay with us. We need to take a break right now. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, your host. And our engineer this evening, Neil Heaver, is working the board for us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
I have in my hands a copy of the book that Richard F. Hope has written called Santa Claus, A Guidebook for Grown-Ups. I love the title because it seems like an oxymoron. Why would grown-ups be interested in Santa Claus, huh? But you can hear from the way Richard Hope chuckles that he would be an ideal Santa Claus. In fact, on the back cover of the book is a picture of him dressed in a Santa suit. Now, you don't actually claim that this long white beard is yours, huh?
It is not.
All right. Thank you very much for that clarification.
I did actually grow my own Santa beard when I played it on stage for a while at one point, but it was not that long.
This is a gorgeous, really long. And on the back of the book, it says, here is what you need to know about Santa Claus, his history, international customs, proof of existence, and true nature. Proof of existence. Wow. And you have, when you say his history, international customs, you have his in quotation marks.
I do.
Why?
Well, if you look at what the existence is, the distinction between his and her and all being a hot topic these days, I didn't want to oversell that point.
All right. Okay. Now, later on in our time together, I'll tell a little bit about the structure of the book, because it's 185 pages, It's a soft cover, and it is available, I know for a fact from you telling me, at Siegel Museum in Easton.
I think they have copies, and it's certainly available online from Lulu Press.
Okay. And say the press again.
Lulu Press.
Lulu Press. L-U-L-U.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Lulu Press. Santa Claus, a Guidebook for Grown-Ups. Now, if we go back to what we were discussing before, Richard, the origins of this whole story of Santa Claus and how it developed, there's the legend of the three maidens.
Yes.
What's that called?
Well, that's as good a title as any.
Okay.
And a lot of our Christmas traditions actually came from that story. There were a number of stories about Santa Claus that were then blown up into making him the patron saint of various and sundry sailors and bankers and so on and so forth.
How about pirates?
Well, from sailors, I think you get to pirates very, very quickly. But, right?
Exactly.
Although that's an anachronism from the time we're talking about. But the Three Maidens story is one of the earlier stories, although not the oldest, about the saint. And it comes from the time when before he was a bishop, and he was a young man. He had lost his parents, but he was fairly wealthy. His parents had given him money. And so he, so the story goes, heard of a nobleman in town. This was so during the 300s, so it was during the Roman Empire period. And the nobleman had title. He had family position, but he didn't have any money, which for the time meant that his daughters were not going to have any eligible marriages, and indeed, some versions of the story, he was going to have to sell them into prostitution in order to keep the family going. So Nicholas heard about this, and being a devout young man, decided that he would not allow this to occur. So when the time came for the oldest daughter to either have a dowry and be able to have a husband or face some other fate, Nicholas, in the dead of night, went out into the streets with a bag filled with some gold coins. Chimneys not having been invented at that point, they didn't come until the 1300s, there was a smoke hole in the roof of the house.
It was their style of chimney.
Exactly. And you had a fire in the middle of the room, and the smoke went up the hole, the top. So an oculus, if you will. So Nicholas, in the dead of night, so goes the story, chucked this bag of coins in the smoke hole. And there was the dowry for the daughter, so she was able to get married. And as the second daughter came of age, the same thing happened. And the third daughter came of age. Now, Papa was beginning to figure out what was going on, so he was watching in the street. And when Nicholas did his thing, Papa surprised him. And supposedly Nicholas swore Papa to secrecy, but we know that Papa must have talked because we know the story. So that's sort of the basis for the gifts for children coming down, in our parlance, the chimney, the smoke hole, and where a lot of that tradition that grew up from a much earlier time.
As I understand it, in early times, if a child received a lump of coal in the stocking, that was a good thing because people needed to heat the houses.
I wouldn't say so.
No.
That's really more from the Dutch tradition, and of course we're not there at this point. But there is a painting by Jan Steen. It was done in the 1660s, and he actually repainted it several times, in which it is shown a Dutch Sinterklaas celebration. Interesting date because that was a Protestant era, and St. Nicholas was not quite outlawed in Holland, but close. Indeed, was heavily discouraged by Protestant town governments. But Jan Steen, the painter himself, was a Catholic. The painting shows a little girl having received her toy in this case a dolly, and the little boy who received coal and switches, and he's crying in the corner and being comforted. So it was clearly, at least in the little boy's view, not a favorable
thing.
That
was not a favorable, right. And of course, that today the tradition is to tell children, if you're not good, then you're going to get a lump of coal from Santa. And that's definitely negative.
That's definitely negative. Now, in the Dutch tradition, of course, it goes one step further, because Sinterklaas not only comes himself as a bishop, as St. Nicholas was, but he has a servant, possibly a slave, who is black. Zwarte Piet, Black Pete. And Black Pete does all the carrying. Black Pete's the one who goes down the chimney. The bishop doesn't do that. It's much beneath the bishop's dignity to do such a thing. But the deal is that Zwarte Piet has the gifts in a bag, and when the bag is empty, if a child in the house has been particularly bad, Zwarte Piet will take the child as it sleeps, chuck it in the bag, haul it back to the saint, and the saint will then take the child back with him away from his home when the saint retires to his home in Spain. Why Spain, I don't know necessarily, but that's
a faraway land.
A faraway land, yes. Probably because that was the source of Catholicism to the Dutch, and St. Nicholas, Sinterklaas, was vaguely Catholic, so that must be where. And even to this day in Holland, Sinterklaas comes on a boat from Spain and lands and travels around the Dutch cities with Zwarte Piet, oftentimes many Zwarte Piets, and distributes toys and checks out the kids. They have to recite for him and show that they're worthy of their gifts. And it's all very, very serious in Holland.
Santa Claus catechism.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow, so many traditions have grown up in different countries, too.
That's right.
And in your book, you list more than a couple of dozen countries and what Santa Claus is called there and some facts about how his presence is celebrated in that particular country. Let's go back now to advance from
the thrilling history of yesterday.
Yeah, that's right. The Dark Ages and move into medieval Europe. And how popular was St. Nicholas?
By the late Middle Ages, St. Nicholas had become overwhelmingly popular. He was a saint for everybody, not just sailors and bankers, but children and merchants and women. People would pray to him for babies, for menstrual health, all of that sort of thing. He was overwhelming, and probably the most popular saint after Mary, after the Virgin Mary.
Wow.
And how he got there is really sort of interesting. Partly it was the returns from these pilgrimages, but it was really two things. It was his Byzantine Eastern Roman Empire origins. He had become a popular cult in Constantinople. A number of the Byzantine, the powers that be in the Byzantine court had written histories of him, especially, interestingly enough, folks from the Greek-speaking colonies in southern Italy, which becomes important in due course. And in the 900s, the Byzantines were busy trying to reestablish their power. They were having trouble against turbulent tribes and, of course, the rising Muslim onslaught from the south. So they sent, at one point, Basil sent a couple of his sisters, one of them north to a Viking people, an uncouth barbarian, according to Anna, who was detailed off to marry this guy, and he had to put away several hundred concubines because she insisted that, as a good Christian, she could be the only woman in his life, at least officially. And she wrote a number of letters to her sister, Theophano, who got detailed off to marry the other big barbarian in the world, which was the Holy Roman Emperor in Germany.
And what century are we talking?
The 900s, the 10th century. Mm-hmm. So Theophano is a fascinating figure, and I don't know why she hasn't attracted more attention. But, of course, Byzantine-educated, Greek-speaking, sent off to this German land to marry this guy, of course, she'd never seen. And he ended up dying shortly after she got there, but she did have a child, which was helpful. Otto died, leaving her in possession of the court. And she basically ruled the Holy Roman Empire with her prelates and advisors from the Byzantine lands as regent for her young son. Was a towering figure of medieval Europe. And as a woman, of course, this was not the norm.
What's her name?
Theophano.
Theophano. You're right, she's not well known.
No, definitely not. But she brought with her, as an official cult, Nicholas, St. Nicholas. And so, since it was popular in court, of course, it became popular everywhere. The Normans at this point, who I mentioned, had picked it up on pilgrimage. They were adopting it at about the same time, and they were busy conquering everything in sight. And so it became important in their lands. Now, they conquered England, among other places, and big chunks of France, but also southern Italy, where the prelates came from who had written the biographies of St. Nicholas. So they ran into it on the backside, and it became part of a huge political plot to extend the possessions, the land possessions, of one of the Norman lords. And the sort of the background on, the backstory on that is that by now we're in the 1000s, and the Byzantines are not doing well against the Muslims in particular. The Sultan and the new powers from the east are busy overwhelming Byzantine lands. And among other places, they're invading what became Turkey. And it became Turkey because they were Turks. It had previously been Greek-speaking lands and had been part of the Greek-speaking empire, really. So the Turks were taking over the area around Myra that was the shrine for St. Nicholas. And some of the Italian sailors from Bari, a town in southern Italy, had the bright idea that they would pop on over to Myra and, in passing, would rip off the bones of the saint and establish him somewhere in their town in Bari, and thereby get the pilgrimage trade. But of course, the excuse was saving him from the encroaching Muslims, which they did. The Venetians had a go at it after them, and depending on who you talk to, some folks will tell you that the folks in Bari were deceived as to what bones they carried off, and others will tell you the Byzantines were too, or the Venetians were too. So the folks in Myra will tell you that there's still at least a good chunk of him left. I don't know who's correct. Maybe DNA will tell us one day. But in any event, Bari, in the lands of these Norman lords in southern Italy, became a very important source. And the Bohemund, one of the younger sons, approached the new pope, Clement, and said, okay, you've got a couple of problems. You've got the Muslims are encroaching, are sweeping, essentially, Christian lands in what is considered Greater Greece. You also have political problems with the Byzantine Empire. You've got this political fight with the prelates there. Now, here is an opportunity for you to come in as the savior. As the Bari people saved the saint's relics from Muslim incursion, so you can go in and save the Byzantine Empire from Muslim incursion and use as your symbol the saint, St. Nicholas.
St. Nicholas.
Clement bought the idea. He was looking for ways to really soak off some of the knightly fervor of especially French-speaking knights from the coast, and so he preached what ultimately became the First Crusade, and went off to conquer Jerusalem, sent them off in the name of both St. Nicholas. The send-off was actually in St. Nicholas's crypt, as it was ultimately established in Barry, and St. George. Got to have St. George, right? And the dragon. that First Crusade then did conquer Jerusalem. But Bohemund and his Normans went along with it. They did not go all the way to Jerusalem. They used it as a pretext. And after the city of Antioch was conquered en route, they sat down at Antioch and said, fine, we've got ours. This is our land now. And you crusaders want to go on and do the Jerusalem thing, be my guest, have a nice life. But in the meantime, you can pay us toll anytime you're sending your goods back to the Byzantines through our Antioch kingdom here. Thank you very much. So Bohemund got his Christmas wish, essentially, from St. Nicholas in a funny way.
So we have religion and commerce mixing here, politics.
And warfare, which the identification then of Nicholas with the First Crusade in particular, but subsequent crusades also used him as a saint in conjunction with it, has made Santa Claus more difficult to accept in Muslim lands, because there is this historical and thousand-year-old now, but this is a tradition that is not one that they're particularly anxious to embrace.
Right. So. Well, the Christians have certainly picked up on St. Nicholas through the years.
They have.
And we are going to have to take another break at this point. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what happened with the Christian
Reformation, probably.
Reformation, exactly. Yeah. And then as Santa Claus makes that trip across the Atlantic Ocean and comes to the U.S., and how does that story develop of his? Richard Hope, author of Santa Claus, A Guidebook for Grownups, is my guest on Lehigh Valley Discourse this evening. I'm John Pierce. Our engineer, Neil Heaver, is doing the work on the board, and we will be back in 60 seconds.
Okay. Segment three, rolling, Don.
Well, it's the time of year that we begin to see Santa Claus pop up all over the place in malls and stores, and we're following that tradition this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. The book, Santa Claus, A Guidebook for Grownups, has in the table of contents the true nature of Santa Claus, the historical Santa Claus, which we've been talking about this evening with the author Richard Hope, and then finally Santa Claus Worldwide. So we're into medieval Europe, and then we come to the Reformation in the 16th century, and what happens to the Santa Claus, or what happens to the St. Nicholas?
Well, of course, a large tradition. Part of the Protestant Reformation was disaffirmation of saints. Luther felt that an awful lot of money and attention was being lavished on saints' days and saints and so forth. And by implication, St. Nicholas was the big point of that attack. So Protestants generally thought that any attention to saints at all, and St. Nicholas in particular, was a problem and should not be tolerated. And Protestant lands actually would outlaw any kind of veneration of St. Nicholas, and indeed they went so far as to outlaw Christmas in many countries, England and Holland, among others. So this became an issue for children, as you can see, but the saint was heavily disfavored, and the Counter-Reformation really didn't push St. Nicholas in response. So St. Nicholas faded into almost a folk character in a lot of Europe, became shadowy figures in Germany, the Beltsnickel and some of these characters that were shaggy, almost like the Svarte Peets, only they became almost animalistic, as we talked about, to hide them from the authorities in Protestant lands. The bishop still existed, the saint still existed in Catholic lands in Austrian areas. But in places like Spain, they really didn't pay a whole lot of attention to him. He never really caught on there. The kids, however, in some countries, like Holland, really liked their Santa Claus, and they insisted on maintaining the tradition. And, of course, Holland very quickly, although it considered itself a staunchly Protestant land and was constantly at war with the French, Louis XIV, and all of that, they did tolerate Catholics operating small churches in their houses. And we saw painter Jan Steen, even in the 1660s, the height of some of that controversy, maintained for his family a St. Nicholas tradition. Would not have been very popular outside the home, but it was there. However, the kids in Holland really liked some of the local traditions. They had cookies, St. Nicholas cookies, and baked goods, and some of the traditions of getting gifts on St. Nicholas's Saint's Day, the 6th of December. So not at Christmas
not
time.
Not what we consider to be Christmas.
No, not at all. So they actually marched in protest in Amsterdam against the laws that were outlawing people from celebrating Christmas. And in Holland, they sort of won their point. In England, Christmas came back with the restoration of Charles II in 1660. But St. Nicholas never really did. He became a shadowy folk figure, as he had in much of the rest of the world. In, of course, his father Christmas in Britain and Père Noël in France. But the Dutch kids were into it, and they maintained more of a tradition with it, at least if they weren't adamantly Protestant about their existence and banning it, as a good Protestant would do, of course, having nothing to do with a saint.
Well, how did Santa make that trip across the Atlantic Ocean and get to the New World? Was that more Dutch influence, English influence?
It was really Dutch influence. And again, it is a big dispute as to exactly what happened. Some parts of the story was that Dutch New Amsterdam, what's now New York, embraced the tradition and actually looked for the boat to come at about that time and bring presents. There are other people who have examined documents from the time and said, no, it's really not true. It almost certainly survived as an upstate New York tradition. We see Fenimore Cooper, for instance, talking about it being in the upstate New York frontier areas in some of his Leatherstocking tales. But it is unclear how widespread it was, because New Amsterdam was very much a Protestant project. And so many of the people there would have regarded it as not something they wanted to be associated with. But New Amsterdam did pride itself on its tolerance of everybody. I mean, you know, even Muslims. you could be in New Amsterdam, and the pirate tradition, the pirate ships put in with their booty and sold with impunity. The slave trade was alive and well running out of New Amsterdam. And there probably was a tradition. It probably did survive, but it may not have been as widespread as some of the subsequent publicists said. What ended up really mushrooming the thing was the politics after the American Revolution. When the American colonists were trying to distinguish themselves from England. And so they were looking around for American traditions and customs that were non-English. And one of these that came to their attention was the Dutch traditions and Dutch culture. So some of the New York gentlemen, especially Washington Irving, latched onto Dutch tradition, and especially the stories of Santa Claus and the traditions of Santa Claus. And so Irving's Knickerbocker Tales, which were published in the very early 1800s, included numerous references to St. Nicholas, and a lot of sort of whimsical approach of St. Nicholas flying over the trees in a cart drawn by goats and things like that.
Those were the reindeer of those days.
And again, there is controversy over where he got it, which we'll talk about. But the St. Nicholas story then really mushroomed in the 1820s with a poem that we attribute to Clement Moore, The Night Before Christmas. Again, there's controversy. The origins of the story, Clement Moore originally said that he didn't write it, and then later in life his daughter got him to supposedly admit that he had written it, and he took credit for it. On the other hand, an upstate New York guy from Poughkeepsie area named Henry Livingston, who did write poetry of that sort, which Clement Moore did not, was an expert in reindeer, among other things, was three-quarters Dutch, was steeped in the Dutch tradition. His family claimed that Henry Livingston wrote the poem, never published it, and that a governess had given it to Clement Moore and that Clement Moore had ripped it off. Which is an interesting problem. Clement Moore was the son of the Episcopalian bishop of New York and an upstanding figure and so on and so forth. Interestingly enough, there was another poem about Santa Claus that was written the year before this poem was supposedly done. And one expert, Don Foster, has come to the conclusion that Clement Moore wrote a poem about Santa Claus, just not the poem about Santa Claus.
The one that we know.
And his daughter eventually he sort of threw in the towel and agreed that he would take credit for it, Henry Livingston now being safely dead and his family not having a very live voice. But it's interesting, there were a number of things that Foster adduces, but the kind of killer evidence that he points out is the names of the reindeer that were involved. Two of them in particular are in the version we know, Donder and Blixen, the German words for thunder and lightning. In Dutch, however, they are slightly different words, Donder and Blixen, and in addition to being the names for thunder and lightning, they are also a sort of an upstate Dutch curse word, Donder en Bliksem. And when Clement Moore wrote out the poem holographically later in life, he included the German versions of the names in the poem as he wrote them out. However, if you look at the original newspaper publication in 1823, they were not the German versions. They were the Dutch versions that Henry Livingston would have written as a pun on this Dutch oath that would have taken. So Foster took, among other things, that as a smoking gun, that Livingston had actually written it and Clement Moore had ripped it off, as indeed Clement Moore ripped off some other things too.
And in that poem, we have the description of Santa Claus, little old driver, so lively and quick. Well, when I see the Santas at the malls today, I don't see anybody who's little or quick.
No, and not an elf.
What happened?
Publicity, PR. Santa Claus is a product in part of advertising. And in particular, well, there were really two phases. Santa Claus grew a little bigger when Thomas Nast, the cartoonist for the Republican Party, really, took him over. In his early days, he started writing an annual Christmas cartoon, and it very often featured either Nast was a German, and so he had... he drew Santa Claus as a sort of a Belznickelish figure with furs. So that's where the fur came from. Originally brown, but in the late 1860s, the new color processes came from the book, and the publisher told Nast that he couldn't possibly have a brown coat. It had to be something that would pop on the page. So it became red, like the red coats of St. Nicholas as the bishop.
It's all about commercialization.
It is. But then in the 20th century, Coca-Cola, a drink you may have heard about at some point. They were a summer drink from sleepy time down south, Atlanta way, and they wanted to market for all year. So they adopted Santa Claus and were showing Santa Claus as drinking Coca-Cola at Christmas time. And their cartoonist, the guy that was drawing the pictures, was a guy named Sundblom, and he was a huge Swedish guy. And he drew himself as the Santa Claus. So here we have the red furs from Nast and this huge Swedish guy in advertising for Coca-Cola during the 1920s. That became the image. And as Coke then became a popular drink, the country also got the Santa Claus of Coca-Cola in time for World War II to spread it all over the world. So that's the Santa Claus we got.
Commercialization of Santa Claus.
Now, Santa Claus, of course, comes on Christmas Eve. And that is actually, that partly dates back to a compromise made by Luther, because Luther and his wife, which was part of the, he had married a nun, that was part of why he left the Catholic Church, because he wasn't supposed to do that. He had kids, and his kids, like the Dutch kids, were not anxious to give up their presents from St. Nicholas on St. Nicholas Day. So as a compromise, Luther with his children, he said, well, all right, the Christ child will bring the toys on the Christ child's birthday instead of St. Nicholas. The Christ child, of course, in German being der Christkind. So that's where you get Kris Kringle as an alternate name for Santa Claus.
And that goes back to Martin Luther.
Yeah. So now you've got these traditions as they conflict back into each other back in Holland. You have Sinterklaas coming in the beginning of December for presents, and you have American Santa Claus, Christmas Man, as they call it, Kerstman, who has gifts on Christmas. And some families actually celebrate both. The kids win twice and they get dual gifts. Depends on how adamantly Dutch you want to be in their traditions.
And one of the things that I like very much about your book is that you include the letter by little Virginia O'Hanlon.
Yes.
In 1897, who lived in New York, I believe, and her father told her, if you have any doubt about Santa Claus, write to the editor of the New York Sun. And because if you see it in the Sun, it's true. And so you tell this story, and the answer to little Virginia's question, is there a Santa Claus, it's the...
Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus.
That's the title of the editorial, and I think the most outstanding editorial that I've ever read.
The editor who wrote that didn't want the assignment. He regarded it as an unfortunate assignment, but of course it became the defining feature of his career.
Yes, indeed. And then you go on to say that Virginia O'Hanlon Douglas herself became a teacher and school principal. This is the little girl who was 7 years old when she wrote this question to the Sun. She received a master's degree from Columbia University. She died,
which was a bit of a feat at that time.
Exactly, and for a woman, particularly.
Exactly.
She died in 1971 at the age of 81.
Yes.
That's a tidbit that I did not know. I never knew anything about Virginia Hanlon except that she was the little girl who wrote the letter.
Now, in that vein, in the book, I do make a suggestion as to what that Santa Claus does exist, but with an adult's understanding of what Santa Claus is. I mean, a child will tell you that Santa Claus is very old, and that's obviously correct, and that Santa Claus somehow engineers the presents happening. And that's also correct. Now, what is it that engineers the presents delivering? Is it a jolly old man who lives at the North Pole? And that's probably not correct. Again, depending on your point of view.
Very good.
But what does it, if you think about what's going on, Santa Claus, of course, has been a trademark used to advertise products. So I would suggest that the Santa Claus tradition is a franchise, owned, though, by the community, not by any private owner, and that the Santa Claus images and so forth are trademarks, sort of like Colonel Sanders for Kentucky Fried Chicken. The gentleman himself is dead, as indeed St. Nicholas is long dead.
And Colonel Sanders looked somewhat like Santa Claus, didn't he?
In some iterations, I guess he does. But it has really become a force of nature, force in society, in civilization. It's been promoted by government. It's been heavily de-promoted by government. Doesn't matter. Society keeps it going and makes it work. It does, in fact, deliver the presents every year on schedule, on time for the kids, and it gets the job done so that grown-ups can understand this more diffuse nature of what it is. It may need to be personified for little children, but they know in their hearts there's something magic about it all.
Indeed.
And as a grown-up, you begin to understand a little more about the magic and how it works.
Yes. Well, I was naive as a child, and I remember very well the time that my parents kept telling me when I would say, I was in kindergarten, and I said, well, Freddie across the street says that your parents are really Santa Claus. And my parents would say, well, he doesn't know anything. Don't listen to him. And I remember the moment that I found out that there was not someone coming down our chimney. I was in fifth grade, and we were lined up to go for Christmas recess, and the teacher said, now, don't go out and spoil this for little children. Little did she know, she was talking to one of them.
And, of course, the problem is you shouldn't tell children that Santa Claus doesn't exist, because Santa Claus does exist, just with an adult understanding of what it is, which is the point, really, that I wanted to make in the book, that Santa Claus does exist if you have a proper understanding of what Santa Claus is.
Richard Hope, I do thank you for coming. Our time is up. Would you give us a ho, ho, ho?
Ho, 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 ho.
Terrific. This was our Santa Claus today to kick off the Christmas season and the holiday season, with Thanksgiving coming first. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce. Thank you so much for listening this evening. Thanks to Neil Heaver for doing our work on the board. And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.
You better watch out. You better not cry. Better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list, checking it twice. He's gonna find out who's naughty and nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. Oh, you better watch out. Better not cry, better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. So be good, be good, for goodness sake. You better watch out. You better not cry, you better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. Yes, he's on his way. He's got toys all over the sleigh. Santa, he's coming to town. Where'd you go?